Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
We had a great opportunity. You know what I love? So we met the owners of Chimera in person.
I like to say Chimera.
Chimera. The other day.
You like to say Chimera.
Great guys. And they brought with them one of the Chimera.
They brought some backup. Frankie was a little scared. I've been talking shit to him.
Because
he likes to be a smart mouth all the time with
me.
Is
he scared, though? I mean, he's trying to fight he a is. World I said, listen, class boxer.
When you come here, bro, I'm going to punch you in your lip. And he shows up with a fucking two-time.
Oh, is that why he brought him?
Yeah.
Well, here's the funny thing. So we're all sitting, meeting up for dinner, right? Mm. We all sit down. And they bring Chris Algieri. Those of you who know boxing know exactly who that is. Those of you who don't have no idea.
Right.
And none of us had any idea. Yeah, so he sits down.
We were idiots.
He sits down and I'm like, I don't know who this guy is. He looks really fit. Don't know who he is. And they're like, oh, he's one of our brand ambassadors.
Talks really intelligently. So.
Super smart guy. Super nice guy.
Would never guess he's been punched in the head a bunch of times.
Yeah, exactly.
Great vibes. And turns out this guy's a fucking
badass.
He is
a savage. Oh, my God.
He's the former WBO World Boxing Champion and the ISKA and WKA World Kickboxing Champion. He went the distance with Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah.
The crazy part
impressive.
Was he did that right before Pac-Man went on to go fight Floyd Mayweather. Mm-hmm. And so he went 12. That's how close he was to getting that Floyd Mayweather fight, man. So in this episode, we get into, of course, we're going to talk about Mayweather and McGregor with that going on, especially being a guy who was really close to being somebody who got a chance.
He deserves this fight.
Right. And so we get his fight analysis of McGregor and McGregor and
Mayweather.
Also talks about some of the toughest fighters that he ever fought and what it was like to fight Manny Pacquiao. What a great episode, man.
We could articulate like boxing so well. It was fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, we talk about fitness and nutrition.
Got in a mindset, too, of the athlete and a competitor, champion.
Very, very interesting episode. Great guy to talk to. Mm-hmm. I think he'd make a great podcaster one day. In fact, he was actually really good on the mic. Sometimes you get an athlete on the mics and you don't know how it's going to turn out.
Well, he's a commentator for Bellator, so I told him, I was like, man, that's your calling, man.
Yeah,
he did a really good job.
You can check out his Instagram page. It's Chris, spelled C-H-R-I-S, underscore, Algieri, A-L-G-I-E-R-I. Check him out. Awesome dude. You're going to love this podcast. So here we are talking to Chris Algieri. Also, this month, we are giving away one of our most valuable assets. Probably the most valuable thing that we offer at Mind Pump is our private Mind Pump forum.
Oh, it's going up after August, too.
Yeah, the price is going to be going up later
it's
on after this month.
Up.
But the private forum is an incredible resource. I mean, we have, I think, like 2,000 people on there, a lot of which are fitness professionals, doctors. We have Dr. Jordan Shallows on there, Dr. Justin Brink, who we talk about.
Johanna just got on there.
Johanna, another great trainer that I put on. There's also a movement specialist. We have competitors who compete in bodybuilding, who compete in physique and bikini. And then, of course, me, Adam, and Justin are on there every single day. And it's just, I'll tell you what, people ask me all the time where I get the studies that I reference on the show. And I'm going to be honest with you, probably half of the studies that I reference or ones I discover from the forum. I love it. I fucking love it. Like, these people will
lots
post
of smart people, man.
Oh, it's great. And I'll get the studies firsthand from people who are actually in the field studying it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're looking for an incredible resource for fitness information, for people to judge your workout form or your exercise form or how to correct imbalances, all that stuff, our forum is extremely valuable. And this month, we're going to give away our forum for free if you enroll in any of our MAPS programs, whether you enroll in an individual program or you enroll in one of our amazing bundles, including our super bundle, which has all of our programs and is about a year's worth of exercise programming. For more information on all of this, or if you just want to enroll because you're a smart person,
yeah,
the place to do it is mindpumpmedia.com.
Hard time.
Pigeon messages.
He defined hard time.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing like watching the soot come down on man's crack.
Oh. What movie was that?
Don't be a menace while drinking.
Oh, yeah.
When you realize you were going to be in for multiple days there, did you look and say, I got to find the biggest dude and go pick a fight? Like, isn't that the rule? Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, absolutely not.
No?
No fucking way.
Did it crush
everybody
your,
in there looked like a murderer,
ever,
bro.
Did it ever
I'm
cross your mind, though,
shower.
That you're supposed to do that? Isn't that what they
yeah,
say?
Yeah, it did cross my mind to do that and then getting stabbed. like a plastic fork or a knife.
So I feel like if you know, I've never done time like you've done time. So I feel like
I feel like you're lying right now.
I feel like you know that at that moment you have to be thinking in your head
so
like
gangster.
I'm either one, I'm gonna go fuck this dude up, but then you're like you're saying you're nervous, you're gonna get shanked, so you don't do that. But then the other side of that is that means that I could end up being somebody's bitch.
Yeah.
At one point, right? That has to go through your head.
I took the latter.
Yeah. It's a decision that you have to make. It's an honorable one.
It's difficult to find the middle of the pack in the prison yard.
Oh, that could be the worst, right? Getting your ass whipped and getting raped? That's got to be the worst.
Like, yeah, I'm the errand boy.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. If you make the wrong decision,
we'll go get stuff.
You make the wrong decision, you pick the fight, you get beat up, and now you have to be someone's bitch anyway?
Dude, and you know what was crazy? The baddest dude in there was Dominican.
And
I told him I was Dominican. He's like, yeah, but we're not the same Dominican.
Oh,
he didn't claim you.
He totally dissed me.
Oh, he didn't claim you?
Yeah.
So, man, again, back to you saying that he's a shitty storyteller. These are all really good points that should be in the story.
Right. That's why I see.
Did we start?
He's still aggregating data.
We had to do a second podcast just so I could get some of the fucking rest of the goddamn story here. Because tells these, oh, yeah, I went to jail for 4 days.
If we keep asking him, there'll be more.
I got a phone call. That's it. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, you missed the guy with the bologna sandwich. You missed the phone to collect calls. Come on, man. Those are the best pieces of all this.
This one dude told me that I should have thrown the body overboard. He's like, yo, man, no witness, no crime.
I'm like, yeah, next time. I got this.
I'll remember that.
I'll remember that.
They say you become a better criminal when you go away. So I guess that's...
You learn all the secrets.
That's anecdotal evidence right there.
Now, Chris, when we were podcasting earlier and Frankie kept telling his terrible stories, I didn't get a chance to really dive into... you and what your journey from becoming an amateur and then also pivoting from being a kickboxer, then going full boxing, that moment where you had to decide that we didn't, I started to ask you and we didn't finish it. I wanted to know more about what really made you go the boxing direction. And you said a little bit about your history with your grew up being a fan.
And then our fight as well.
Yeah. And that, cause I know that.
We'll talk about that.
We're hyping that up.
But why not MMA, you know?
So, you know, with MMA, so I had, you know, I came from kickboxing and I just thought that, for me to then add more skills and techniques, wouldn't be the same as me kind of taking away and kind of mastering the two that I've already been working on. So I felt more about mastering my hands rather than adding techniques that I'd be kind of playing catch up on.
Do you feel that that's necessary now when you look at MMA? Like I remember watching it when it first started. Remember when it used to be like a boxer versus a karate guy versus, you know, like you had one discipline. Now it seems like you have to be.
Well, MMA is the discipline now.
Right.
Know, like that. And there are literally MMA gyms like that. And that's a pretty recent thing. You know, you've got guys that have now been training MMA for a decade. You know, that wasn't the case, like you were saying early on when it was the boxer versus the jiu-jitsu specialist.
Well, some people think it's training in boxing, training in jiu-jitsu, training in Muay Thai, but it's not even that. It's also learning how to integrate them because boxing for boxing is different than boxing for MMA.
Absolutely true.
You know, grappling for jiu-jitsu is different than grappling for MMA. You have to learn how to integrate them all.
Yeah, but I always love hearing fighters' perspective on this because some of them agree and disagree on this point. I want to hear your opinion. Is should it be in a one house type of deal, or like what I get some guys that I know that are pros that talk to me about, like it's so much better to go to that one discipline
and
master it by one of the greatest masters in that, and go over here, find that one, master that, versus one gym that's kind of hubbing, you know, maybe they have one coach that's really awesome at hands, but then as far as his ground, the other guy who's the ground game guy, well, you know, he's only got about 5 years experience, where you'd be better off going and working outside. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, on that, like, it's not realistic to go master disciplines because you have such a limited amount of time, you know. So if you're starting in your late teens or whatever, and your prime of your fight career is going to be during your 20s, you would be spending time mastering all those disciplines in that case. What I suggest and what I've always found best is I've trained with a lot of different other trainers, and I took from them what I could, like what served me and my style, and I kind of left behind the things that didn't. Right. So I didn't take on their style entirely. I just took on parts of their style that I saw as serving me and for what my ultimate style would be.
Now, we talk a lot about paradigm-shattering moments for us in our career and the things that we do. Did you have moments, like you talk about, you had all these different coaches. I'm sure you've had tons of brilliant minds and talented boxers that you fought with. What did you have moments that was like big learning lessons, like, holy shit, this whole time I've been dipping to the left when he does that? Like, can you remember those moments? Like,
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the thing about, you know, being at the elite level, your mistakes get shown really quickly. You know, you make a mistake, like you said, if I'm dipping this way, it's like these guys let you know immediately.
Yeah.
You know, they're really good at reading things that are going on out there and making adjustments. The best fighters in the world adjust on the fly in seamless manner.
At what level do you start like diving into like your opponent? Like, at what level does that become a huge piece of like studying the opponent? You know,
it depends on, you know, at the lower ranks, like you're not really sure about the guy. It's going to be tough to find YouTube videos on a guy who's, you know, 4-7, you know. But then once you start fighting guys who now have a background, whether it be amateur, because the guy could be 13 or 14-0, because you always have those crossroad fights in the beginning where it's you versus another prospect. Mm-hmm. And the guy who wins goes on.
Do you always know when that is? Like, do you know?
You don't, but you do. You know, like, maybe the fighter might not know, but their management knows. Their team knows, you know. But I think fighters who kind of grew up around the sport or maybe watch sport know those kind of crossroad opportunities.
Oh, wow.
And they happen, like, back to back to back to back. And honestly, it's just like, you got to win. So I won my world title. I was 20-0 at the time. Like, if I had lost at any point leading up to that, I wouldn't have gotten to the fights that I got. Wouldn't even gotten the fights, let alone had a chance.
How many times do you think you've had like a young kid coming up that is a potential prospect in your career that you've had to fight? Like, how many of those?
I mean, it started as early as my national television debut. I fought this kid, Jose Peralta, who was actually Dominican. And the kid was a monster. And I had literally people reaching out to me being like, yeah, don't fight this kid. I've seen him in the amateurs and he's really got a lot of money behind him. And like, he's really coming up. And I was just like, dude, it's TV. This is my opportunity for people to see what I do, hard that I work.
Walk me through that fight. That must have been a fucking
crazy. Was that a hard one?
Yeah, if you guys want to look up a really fun fight to watch, it's Chris Algieri versus Jose Peralta. It was on NBC Sports. This is, 2012 or so. In a 10-round fight, I think CompuBox locked me in at about 1,100 punches.
Holy cow, that's an active fight.
And everybody's like, wow, why did you throw so many punches? Like, did you train to do that? I was like, no, the guy was on me like white on rice, and the only thing I could do to keep him off me was fucking punch. Yeah. So I just let my hands go nonstop. And it became a war of attrition, because in the beginning rounds, it was really tick for tack, back and forth. I was boxing smart early, and then he really brought on the heat. He was a big puncher, caught me a couple times, and then I was just like, you know what? I just need to push. I just need to push until he can't keep up. That's exactly what happened.
What does it feel like?
Us Dominicans are savages. Yeah, we're just blessed with
obviously
genetics.
Yeah. What does it feel? I've always thought to myself when I watch these fights, how does it feel the days after the fight? How's your body feel? What's the healing look like?
So I get that question a lot, and it's really variable. Like, there are fights that literally you could fight a 12-round fight, and you're literally like fine. Like, you're sore from like, and you've had harder workouts during camp. Then you could have a fight that was 5 or 6 rounds and you're sore for like a week. I had a black eye after the Ruslan Provodnikov fight for 3 months.
That's the one that you told us about earlier? Where
that's when I broke my orbital. But like, literally, even after it was completely healed and everything was good, I still had black in my eye well. You know, it was off color. And certain days I'd wake up, be worse than others.
Wow.
You know, just well up.
Yeah, I've heard this too a lot. And can you confirm that? You can feel like another man's spirit when it's been broken, like in a fight.
Oh my God, it's my favorite fucking thing.
Wow. Yes, dude.
So
when the shark eyes come
domination.
Out. When I fought Provodnikov, I said it in one of the pre-fight interviews, which really blew people's mind because I was really unheralded at that point. And I said, you know, our styles are not that different. And everybody scoffed because he was a go-forward Terminator-style Siberian Rocky was his nickname. Murderous puncher, knocked everybody out, took everybody's punch, and just kind of like won fights through war of attrition and big power. And I was a savvy, smooth boxer who got hit very, very little and had good conditioning. So when I compared our styles, they were like, no, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, yeah, but we fight to break our opponent's will. We just do it in different ways. Ruslan does it by landing hard punches, by taking your best shot to the point where you're like, I can't hurt this guy, and he's still coming. And I break your will by being in your face all night and keeping my hands on you and making you miss and making you feel like, I can't beat this guy. He's just too good. You know, so having that moment when you kind of break away, it's probably like a foot race or something where like you get ahead and it's like, now you're in my wake, dude, and you're going to stay there. And you just turn it on from there.
Can you give us a story of a fight that you were in where you was just the most difficult test for you?
Definitely the Pacquiao fight. He was so.
I mean, you went the distance with him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I spent 12 rounds with him over in Macau, China. And he just was really, it was the, I just didn't expect it.
Mexican supplements.
And not even that. I mean, his endurance and his power were great, but it wasn't even that. It was just like, he was so hard to prepare for in terms of style. Like, I had hired the sparring partner that everybody used for Manny Pacquiao. Like, there was this kid, and he's great. He switches sides. He fights southpaw. He's very awkward. He's very jumpy. He moves around great. And it was nothing like the man in the ring. You know, he was just, really? It was crazy. The angles that he was able to cut, the punches that he was able to land from such awkward positions, but still generating power. That was the biggest thing. Because you know when you're safe in a ring. Like, I cut in a corner, I'm like, all right, this guy can't hit me hard here. And then Manny does.
Is there a moment during the fight where you felt like he earned your respect on that level where you're like, fuck, this dude is that good? Does that ever cross your mind while you're fighting?
Oh, yeah. And it happens in fights where fights that I won. Like, I'm in there, I'm like, all right, this guy could really fucking scrap. Or this guy's tricky or scary or dangerous. You know, some guys really got their Sunday punch. And they're not really great fighters, but they're really good at setting up that shot. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily that shot knocks you out, but it clips you and it hurts you.
Oh, wow.
And you carry that for a while. Even if you get rocked or stunned or whatever, you carry that punch with you for at least a few rounds.
What do you mean by that? What does that feel like? What do you mean?
So it could be a couple things. It could be one, like literally you got rocked equilibrium-wise, and it can take a few rounds to come back.
So you just feel off?
You're just off. So every step is a little bit off. Your feeling is a little weird. You think you're standing still, but your body's... is actually swaying or rocking.
You got off a boat.
you lose your land legs kind of. And then, but then there are other shots they hit you. Like it could be like your broken orbital. My eye break, you know, and my eye is swelling now. So I'm carrying that into the next couple of rounds. Or I break my nose, or my nose is bleeding. Now my breathing is inhibited. It's going to change the outlook of the fight moving forward. So every punch can literally change the story.
I've talked to boxers in the past, friends of mine, and they said that you can kind of train yourself to learn how to get punched is that truth?
Yeah, I mean you see it a lot when guys, when they come off of long layoffs and they kind of like get rung by punches than it used to. Those little muscles in your neck and like catching those punches and your body's ability to like kind of like tighten up fast when something's coming, when you see that punch and you're like, you know, and that's a big thing, is getting hit with punches that you see versus punches that you don't. It's the ones that you don't. They don't have to be that hard. You know, just your body's not reacting the same
way. That's what I've heard people say. Is there any truth to, we've talked about this on several episodes. People have asked us questions about old man strength. And I had a friend who was a boxer, older gentleman. He actually was a client of mine in his 70s. And he said the last thing to leave a man is his power.
Yeah.
Is that true? That's true.
Yeah, totally. So my pro kickboxing debut, I was 19 years old. Couldn't even shave yet. I fought my pro debut a guy who was 37.
Oh shit.
And so it was the youth versus the experience.
It's like fighting your dad.
Strength, literally.
Young lion versus old lion.
Yeah, and it was just like, all right, I'm like I'm not going to be stronger than this guy. And I'd seen him on the circuit before, like I knew, you know, about him and his style. I knew he was kind of tricky, and he was a good puncher. He knocked people out. I was just like, I just got to overwhelm him and just kind of stay on him. And when he wants to rest, not let him. And that's exactly what happened. I knocked him out in the third round, but
Now, do you get a lot of help to, like, I mean, the way you analyze another fighter and how you prepare for a fight, is that all on you? Or do you have a team now of guys that, like, help you, like, listen, this guy, watch this? I mean, how does that?
There's kind of two schools of thought there. Some fighters hate watching tape, and they hate watching fights, especially their opponent before, as they're getting ready for them. And then in that case, you're going to have your team do the work. And I think that's really important. Tape review is really, really important to watch a guy. I'm not a huge proponent of watching tape. I just want to know kind of maybe a little bit stylistically how they're going to move and whatnot. But then there are guys who watch like tons of tape.
Is that because you don't want to overthink it, or what's your reason behind that? Why are you?
I'm a rhythm fighter, and I think of that if I'm watching a video, I can't guess someone's rhythm based on who they're fighting, because your rhythm changes with who you're in the ring with. And I always feel like I'll figure that out quick in the ring.
You know? So you try and find like training partners that somewhat emulate that, though, at least so you can
exactly
get a feel.
Yeah. At the very least, like have the right side forward. If you got a southpaw who's fighting with his right hand in front, or you got an orthodox who's fighting with his left in front, but also like certain tells, like this guy dips to his right, this guy's got a big left hook, so I want a sparring partner who's got a big left hook. If I'm training for a guy, you know, it's funny, even at the highest level, a guy like Tito Trinidad, who is known for his left hook, you're not going to spar a guy who's a big right hand, you know, doesn't have a good left hook, because the punches are coming from literally the opposite angle. So you you kind of ingrain and program all that.
I like watching tape.
Do you? Yeah.
We know Chris's what kind of tapes you watch,
but he has nothing on me, so. Nothing on
YouTube. Yeah, what's going on with that? You guys are going to do some...
I'm 100-0 in the streets.
So I didn't realize this, but I got brought on by Khmer Coffee just so I could fight Frankie. Yeah. So that's that. They were really, they were hand-picking. Dude,
Manny Pacquiao doesn't have
the Don King
baby.
Of coffee over here, huh?
Yeah.
Frankie's good. Also the matchmaker for Khmer Coffee, yeah. So.
apparently.
He won't know what hit him.
Yeah. Are you really going to YouTube this? Are you going to do this?
Yeah, dude. He doesn't stand a chance.
Oh, my God, dude. Did you get insurance or anything before you did this?
Why
did
would I? Okay. Have you seen my frame?
You going to wear a helmet?
I'm freaking 6'5", 250 pounds, 4% body fat.
In your head.
Yeah.
What?
In your head.
I don't know, man.
It's because we're on a podcast.
That's
why
you ate.
That's why you could do that for video.
Is this on video?
Yeah.
Dude, I hope you have dental insurance,
picture
man.
Of you.
Teeth are expensive.
Yeah. He knows.
He definitely knows, yeah. For sure.
I got a professional mouthpiece, man. So I put it in, right in the streets.
So training-wise, to give yourself the type of first off, what kind of fitness does one need to be a boxer? Because sports require specific types of fitness. I mean, you're going to need a particular type of it. I remember when I trained a lot in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I had really good stamina or decent stamina for Jiu-Jitsu. And I remember I had a friend of mine who was a kickboxer, and all he did was hold pads for me. And I remember how fast I got fatigued doing that, and I realized it was so different in terms of the type of endurance or type of what kind of fitness do you need for boxing in particular.
So that's a really interesting question, because you know the different biomotor abilities that you need, you know, sport to sport. I almost liken boxing to like a soccer midfielder, where you've got to be able to constantly move but also have short sprints and explode. But also you got to incorporate the upper body movement, you know, the upper body strength. So it's basically a movement where you have to be able to constantly move, so you've got that base endurance, but then also explode, sprint, and generate power. You know, so it encompasses so many different biomotor abilities. It really is tough to train everything at once. You really got to.
Do boxers nowadays still do lots of road work like the boxers of the old, you know, old days?
Yeah, they do. It's really an antiquated way to train, I think, especially steady state running, which a lot of guys do. They just run 5 miles a day.
That was old school, right?
Yeah, totally old school. Totally old school. And honestly, you still see it now in new school, where I think short sprint work is probably better, you know, hit training. You know, it's good to have some over distance training, but I would say once a week, and then I would say do much more sprint work, because that would equate to throwing combinations.
A smart guy like you got to see. I want to know from your perspective what you think is kind of wrong with a lot of the training that you see in dieting and stuff like that.
Because
what do you see is most wrong in boxing right now with your training and nutrition?
Probably the scariest thing that I see in terms of training and nutrition is weight cuts. But I see a lot of guys, and I've been seeing this for years, they cut their water really early because they're afraid of the number on the scale.
Oh, wow, really?
Like, I see guys literally in sparring sessions who won't drink water in the corner. Right. Yeah, Adam just made a face like that's ridiculous.
Crazy.
And it is. It is. But literally, that's, you know, we're still in this day and age, people are doing that. They're cutting their water a week out from a fight, 2 weeks out from a fight, because they don't understand human physiology and how body water is held. Mm-hmm. And that's scary, because then you got guys getting hit in the head in a dehydrated state.
Right.
You know, a chance of a brain injury. And brain injury doesn't just happen in fights. That goes into sparring as well.
Right,
we fight when we spar. Mm-hmm. You know, we wear more gear, but we're still trying to knock each other out.
Yeah, you're still getting jarred.
Do they still do the IV, like after the weigh-ins and all that?
Some guys do. You'll find that much more in MMA athletes and you know, that level where those guys do like really, really aggressive weight cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Some boxers do. That's probably less common.
Yeah.
What about resistance training wise, like with weights? How does that incorporate it with boxers at your level?
How do you periodize like your entire approach with this?
Yeah, we spoke about this earlier, and it's like it's really tough because a lot of times, so working with fighters and combat athletes, they're generally in a catabolic state. right? They're always trying to lose weight. If the scale goes up, I heard on a podcast you talking about your scale going down and freaking out.
Right.
Fighters are the opposite. Scale goes up at any time. If I wake up 2 pounds heavier, it's like, fuck. I got to do extra work now. I got to, you know, I got to drink less or eat less and go for an extra run now because I'm 2 pounds heavier today. Versus other athletes where anabolism is key and you just want to grow and never be depleted. Fighter is constantly living that depleted state. So with a strength coach working with a fighter, it's difficult. You might make all these gains during camp, and then the last 2 weeks when they're cutting the weight, just throw it out the window.
Right.
Guys kill themselves to make weight. I've seen great camps, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks of awesome work,
wow,
get ruined by 5 days of weight cut.
You saying that makes me think it's probably so much more beneficial than to always kind of hang around pretty close to your weight where you're going to be fighting at, because when you think about it, even if you put all this extra work into building 20 pounds of lean mass over the off season, you got to cut anyways. You put yourself in a catabolic state for that long of a period of time, everything's going to fall off.
Absolutely.
And you'll be right back where you were, but you didn't have to do all that hard ass work to put that on and put all that stress on your body to get there.
Exactly.
The other thing that comes to mind too is if you're doing a lot of training at a heavier body weight, you may be used to moving with a bigger body. You may have different timing. Then you cut all this weight. What does that do to a boxer's timing?
So that's another pitfall that I see with guys is that, so say for example, I was talking MA earlier, but I used the weight class like the 170ers. So you got a guy at 170 who probably in the off season is like 205. You know, once he starts his camp, he's going to be in like the mid 90s or low 90s. And the bulk of his maybe sparring and training is going to be around like 84, 85, 185, mm-hmm. right? So then he cuts down, he makes 170, and then he's going to refeed back up. And then the guy ends up stepping into the cage at 195 or 200.
Right.
You're a different guy. You said, your body's different. Your body's going to move different. Your lungs are going to move different. The stresses on your body are going to feel different. Your timing's off. Your hand position, body position, everything. You have a different body. Mm. And you've done the bulk of your work 10 or 15 pounds lighter. You're doing yourself a serious disservice.
A lot of people don't realize, even 5 pounds. So being somebody who messes with his weight a lot, going up and down, competing with shows, I can see a huge difference with a 5 pound up or down.
And you're a big guy.
Right.
And you're a big guy noticing 5 pounds. Now imagine being like my weight, 155 pounds, 160 pounds, and then feeling what the 5 pounds is like.
Right.
You know, like it's a big deal.
Yeah.
So you've actually helped other fighters with this process of doing it like in a more healthy way. I know we've made some kind of like comparison, like a Mike Dolce of like the MMA world. Like, is that something that you could see yourself sort of becoming in the boxing world?
Yeah, I think I could do a lot of good because of my background and experience and my education. I actually got brought on by Daniel Jacobs in his fight versus the Triple G, who's a guy's a monster.
Oh wow!
They fought at the Garden. Danny is a guy that I fought on the same card with for years, and his team had reached out and said, "Hey, like you do this nutrition diet stuff, like would you want to come to camp?" So I was actually hired as the in-camp nutritionist. I meal planned everything out, helped him make the weight. But I am an amateur chef. I like to cook. So I end up cooking every meal for him throughout the camp as well. So like, and we found this great synergy. And he was amazed about how much food he was able to eat like throughout the camp, how good he felt, how his recovery was, and how easily he still made weight. You know, and it was like, he's like, dude, you're part of the team until I'm done.
So what I had to constantly be in his ear the whole time, right? Because he was like paranoid.
More with his team. Danny trusted me 100%. He's like, we're good, right, champ? I'm like, yeah, we're good. He's all like, right. Okay. But his team was like, Chris, when's that weight coming off, huh? He's still a little heavy. I'm like, we're good. He's drinking 2 gallons of water a day. It's not going to be light. It's cool. Yeah, right. He'll make the weight.
What kind of nutrition strategies do you use with an athlete like that in terms of, you know, proteins, fats, carbohydrates, or even just the types of foods that you're feeding them? What are some rules that you try to follow?
So hydration is super variable, but I like to weigh my guys in before they work out and after they work out and see what their drift is during that time. Mm-hmm. Also get an idea of how much they drift overnight. They get kind of an idea of what kind of sweater they are, what their sweat rate is, what their water loss rate is. You'll find with guys throughout camp that'll change too. As they get leaner and there's less body fat covering their muscle tissue, and their muscle tissue is actually their lean tissue is at their highest, they will lose water really fast.
Yeah.
So following them during their camp and seeing how that changed and adjusting their water intake is really important. And when it comes to actual like macronutrient distribution throughout camp, you need carbs. It's an explosive sport. There's a major endurance aspect to it. There's a lot of cardio involved in the training itself. So carbs are something that I really will push up until just the last couple of weeks. And then as we get into like what I consider like the the cut phase or the fight preparatory phase, I'll really put the carbs around the most important performance part of their training, which would be their sparring. Mm. Okay, they can feel a little rough on a technique day, but I want them to feel good on their sparring day. So we'll focus on carbing up the night before and immediately after.
You even manipulate their carbs based off of what you're doing for training. That's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, being able to cycle their carb intake so they can kind of lean out some in between. The idea really is you gotta assess the guy properly. You gotta figure out what his body fat is at the beginning of camp, what he weighs at that point, and then assess, all right, how lean can we get you and maintain as much lean body tissue as possible, and then pull enough water out of you to make to that weight.
What are the carb sources that you tend to pick for your fighters?
I keep it pretty simple. I'm big on oats, of course, oatmeal, whole grain breads, things like that. I'm a potato guy, but I have a lot of guys who are pasta guys. Potatoes, pastas, cereal grains, granolas, tons of veggies, a lot of colors, really big on colors. Mm. And I've recently really got into nitrates and vasodilators to really help with recovery.
Like beets?
Beet juice, pomegranate. Mm. There's a lot of really, really cool research on pomegranate juice and pomegranate seed extract and how it vasodilates and in a similar fashion to beet juice. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I was using pomegranate juice as a pre and then beet juice as a post for recovery. The pomegranate juice works faster than beet juice. So you got about a 30-minute window where it starts to kind of open everything up. So I want those guys having those nutrients and those carbs in their system so they can go out there and perform at their best. And then right after, throw in the beet juice, again, open everything up. Let's get recovery nutrition in. Let's get the carbs and protein right away and get them to kind of recover and then go chill.
Yeah, especially for high-intensity type endurance type athletes, they've shown that these high nitrate foods have a performance boosting benefit. It's funny because I'll get messages from people, hey, should I be having beet juice before or pomegranate juice before my workouts? I'm like, well, what do your workouts look like?
Yeah.
And they'll say, like, no,
you're not on that level.
Yeah, you're fine, dude. You're not going to see anything from drinking.
Calm down. Zumba. So,
yeah, exactly. what about protein intake? I'm assuming you need an adequate amount of protein for recovery, but too much protein may be counterproductive. What does that look like?
Again, that's going to depend on the camp and where we're at in terms of the weight-making stage and what preparation level we're at. Protein is important. It's kind of one of those things where I try and get it in at some point throughout the day. Doesn't need to be a ton. It's not an efficient fuel source for these guys. Their energy is going to come from the carbs. But from a recovery aspect, it's really important. Mm-hmm. I'll focus it more around their strength training days, around their sparring days where they're really kind of getting beat down and recovery is going to be more important.
Now, do you coach and help them with what is widely considered to be one of the most important parts of preparing yourself for competition, the mental aspect? Is that something that you work with people with as well?
So that was a secondary job that Jacob's camp had brought me on for because I had been to the highest level. I'd seen what this is like. I'd seen what fighters go through during camp. And Danny really trusted me in that regard as well. So we had a lot of personal time to spend, and we got to talk about these kinds of things, from a technical aspect, but also from that psychological mindset of getting ready for what we're about to do. So that becomes important. And just hearing someone tell you that, like, we're in a good position right now, and we're going to make the weight no problem, and you're going to feel like a fucking monster on fight night. From someone who's done it is really satisfying, gratifying, or gives these guys a sense of calm where they'd be like, all right, we're doing everything right. I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, and any competition I've ever been in, I have a real easy time training. Leading up to the competition, I learned real quick that I would exhaust myself from the stress and anxiety of the upcoming competition. And in some of the first competitions I did, I would be exhausted. And I couldn't believe it. I thought I was more fit than this. It's because I got so tired. How did you deal with that yourself going in? Did you have those kind of nerves, and did you figure out strategies to deal with that?
Absolutely. So I was a big visualization guy. I spend my camps at least a few minutes a day, and sometimes I would do more, especially earlier in my career, kind of spending like an hour or so, really just laying. I shut off the lights. I shut the phone off. Everything. Don't leave. I'm in my time. Nobody bother me. Shut everything down. And I will see myself walking into that ring, because that's one of the scariest things in the world. Walking down the tunnel, when you're walking out and you see 20,000 people, you can't even see the people because the lights are like shining on you. Your music is blasting, the music that you chose, which it's war. It's time. Mm-hmm. Everything you've worked for is literally this moment. And you're walking into this tunnel. You're going into the unknown. The ring is highlighted with lights. And like, that's where I'm going. I'm going to meet the man that I've been training to destroy, who's been training to destroy me for months, and this is actually that moment.
What an adrenaline rush.
Yeah. So
a
that,
bunch of drunk people screaming your name.
Yep. or the guy who screams, fuck you, you suck. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So like you've got to be able to just have tunnel vision like at that point. And every time I fought, I've seen that for that night 10,000 times. I've walked into that arena. I've walked into that ring. I've stepped through the ropes. I pulled my robe off when they said my name. I've touched gloves with this guy. I've looked him in his eyes, looked in his fucking soul, and I've been there 10,000 times before I've ever gotten into the ring, because I've spent that time laying in my bed, getting horizontal, feet crossed, eyes closed, just staring. I'm not napping. I'm not sleeping, but I'm kind of in that in-between state and just really running that on a reel. And I will pick throughout camp at what point I'm going to talk about. I think about. I've even done like, all right, I'm in the limo on the way to the arena. You know, I'm getting out of the car with my team. The cameras are in my face. They're taking pictures. They're asking for interviews. You know, I've seen that all before it happens. Hmm. And that really just helps with that sense of calmness and being prepared for.
Do you feel like you've practiced that so well that you can now, like, you feel like when you get into that position, you're like, yeah, I've seen all this. Saw all that. I knew. I heard that. I seen that. Like, have you gotten better and better at doing that? Like, as you've gotten,
I've gotten better at getting into the place where what I'm thinking and doing has the positive effect I'm looking for. I think when I was younger, I had to maybe run it through a lot more because I needed to kind of calm everything down, block everything out, and just like, all right, maybe like the 150th time, I actually see this clearer. Where now it's like I can think about it a handful of times. It's like, all right, I'm in my flow now, mm-hmm. and I'm ready to use this for a positive interaction.
Go ahead.
I want to know if there's certain things that you do to get into that mode. Like we've talked about on our show before, using Brain FM or using cannabis or doing things to get me in that mindset so I
meditation.
Can get into my flow state. Are there practices that you've put in place to do that?
Yeah. I don't talk much during like camp and getting ready for like, even for that, like I'm really preparing for that. Like as soon as my training session ends and I just kind of want to separate myself from interaction. Staying off my phone is big because that's a mind suck, man. That thing you can get right. lost.
Especially if you read what people are saying about the fight and what mm-hmm. they're saying about you.
Yeah. I'm big with like aromatherapy. I really love candles. I will light things and incenses and things like that just to kind of get me to help relax. And Epsom salt baths, hot baths, kind of just really just get my body to chill, which can help my mind come out more. I feel like everything else will melt away and then I'm left with what I need to train at that point.
I feel like fighting, because it is really, if you really examine all sports, they all are extensions of the original competition, which was fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, you're fighting for survival or fighting for resources. And so it's people have referred to all combat sports as the purest of all sports. Has boxing or kickboxing, fighting, has that set a different perspective for you when you go out into life or when you do other things? Does it change things for you? Cause I got to imagine if you can handle visualization, you know, walking into right. an arena, getting ready to
ultimate
fight.
Ultimate stressful
yeah,
situation.
Yeah, Manny Pacquiao
ever.
In front yeah. of all these people, millions of people watching, whatever. Does that change your perspective for, you know, like everyday life?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you have an important phone call or a big meeting or you're trying to get something off the ground, you're going to be anxious. You're going to have anxieties. You're going to have, you know, like, all right, what about this? What about that? It's taught me to be an opportunist. Where in a ring, an opportunity presents itself, you react and you take it. And it's kind of the similar way when I deal with in business or talking to people. It's like an opportunity will present itself because of the way you're talking or what comes in front of you, or you think of that bridge to maybe I need to get this guy to understand what I'm trying to do. Finding that bridge and that commonality is you taking advantage of an opportunity. You see the opportunity and you go. You know, mm-hmm. you take that critical distance line and you cross it. You know, and I think that's something that I can take from my fight career into the real world.
Yeah, I think again, it's just it's got to change your perspective on things. It's almost like,
oh, I love that, dude.
Yeah, we talk to you know, obstacle course racers, for example, and they'll be like, yeah, man, after doing that race, like, I went into the meeting on Monday and I was like, not a big deal, because I almost died right now on this particular yep. race. Or, you know, if you just had a fight, I remember even doing that in when I would train, you know, just for fun, in jiu-jitsu, I'd walk around and just felt very comfortable walk around because I'd just done some grappling fights or whatever.
It's amazing how many things that we don't do out of fear, mm-hmm. you know, because we're afraid yeah. we're going to fail. Because, oh my God, if I do this, I'm going to fail and it's not going to work out. And right away, I feel like so many people get into that game and then, oh, I got to figure it all out before I even think about taking a chance. And I don't know. I have the same type of mentality where I'll just see an opportunity. I'm going to do it, learn from it. No matter what, it's an opportunity for growth, whether it succeeds or fails. I mean, I think too many people procrastinate on shit.
Do you have any favorite boxers from when you were a kid or anyone that you idolized growing up?
Absolutely. I mean, my whole fascination and passion with the sport came from hearing about the greats of yesteryear. You know, my grandfather telling me about Alexis Arguello, the explosive thin man from Nicaragua. And then I remember guys, even personally, myself, watched Mike Tyson, of course, you know, anybody who was alive in the 90s. But Oscar De La Hoya was the guy that like, this is the guy. He could get off camera, he could smile, he was a crossover star, people loved him.
Yeah.
And then in the ring, he was a killer. And he was technically super sound, but also had that killer instinct, and he brought it, you know? So that was the guy I was like, all right, that's the guy.
The golden
to be like,
boy, man.
That's the guy, the crossover star, man. I mean,
how would you say your style, if you were to say, did you emulate anybody's style?
So I've been told I have like a couple different guys in there. Like there were certain aspects of me with my jab that were like De La Hoya, but I'm a lot more of a level changer. I've always been told I kind of fight like an East Coast black guy in terms of being like rhythmic, and I move and change levels, and I'm kind of slick, you know. My nickname when I was a kid was Smooth when I would fight.
Oh, wow.
Smooth, you know, I was like literally a teenager. I was like, God, so smooth, look, you're not trying. So one really old guy that people kind of say is Willie Pep, who was a guy who was like a defensive wizard and changed levels. There's a legend that he won a round without throwing a punch. He was so good defensively making guys miss that he made them look terrible and didn't even throw a punch.
That must have pissed that guy off so bad.
Yeah, the history of boxing is fascinating. I mean, boxing in its early days was crazy. Like, they didn't stop a fight until you died.
You could stand over the guy while he was getting off the ground back then. Oh, so in those big fights, when you would drop a guy, you were allowed to stand over him for him to get up.
Yeah. And they would go on for rounds and rounds.
They didn't have ends.
Like 15
rounds is a lot. They didn't have that. Shit. They had 100 rounds.
This is true. They were actual, you know, fights like that.
Like bare knuckle.
You know, I love watching some of the greats because I feel like they were trailblazers for some of the newer styles that you see, like, you know, Muhammad Ali, the way he boxed and danced and moved. You know, he set up a whole generation of boxing style. And of course, you know, right now we're watching all this hype with Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather and all the hype that they do behind it. Muhammad Ali kind of wrote the book on that. Like, before him, nobody really fucking talk shit like that, you know?
No, exactly. He, you know, the Louisville Lip, like, that was his nickname for a reason. He had the gift of gab, and he would talk these fights up and be able. That was where the promotion of these fights really, really came. Muhammad Ali, the great, was influenced by guys like Sugar Ray Robinson, and by Joe Louis. Joe Louis, like you said, like that transitional style of fighting. Joe was like nobody else back then. He was a good athlete. He was a killer puncher. He knocked everybody out.
Very technical.
Very technical as well. So it was like you had this technical athlete, and it was the first time we've ever really seen that. And then you got a guy like Sugar Ray Robinson who could punch going forward, punch going backward, had great technique, had a great chin, had an awesome gas tank, could fight everybody in the world, fought five different weight classes. He literally was virtuoso, could do it all. And then Ali comes in, and that's when we had the first like super athlete. The way that guy was able to move at 210 pounds.
His accuracy was just insane. They say he wasn't a hard puncher, but he'd hit you so perfectly that he'd put you out.
Timing is a motherfucker, man.
People don't realize how big of a difference timing makes in your power.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Watching MMA, you know, you watch the Diaz brothers and it looks like they're not hitting that hard, but they're beating people up because their timing and accuracy is so good.
They score knockouts and they lump people's faces up. You know, they're not playing pity pat out there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was a big, of course, Rocky Marciano fan because I'm Italian. But, you know, he fought Joe Louis when Joe Louis was way past his prime, and he beat Joe Louis and he cried afterwards because that was his idol.
Yeah, he was a shell of a man at that point.
Yeah,
he was. The money, his taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, you've got the George Foreman, another great, great fighter to watch.
Foreman fight.
Yeah, here's a guy who probably one of the hardest punchers of all time. Gave Muhammad Ali a tough fight. Frazier, who of course beat Ali a couple times, you put Frazier and Foreman in the ring, and Foreman murdered him.
Why?
What is it about styles that changes the dynamics of a fight?
That's what's so great about these sports. It's like all right, well, George Foreman completely starched Joe Frazier twice, and then they're fighting Ali, and Ali had triple time wars with you know, they fought three times, had wars with Joe Frazier. It's like, all right, well,
Foreman's going to beat him.
Foreman's going to crush him. And then they go out there, and Ali wins a war of attrition. Lets him beat on him and knocks him out. It's like that's the storylines in boxing that are incredible when you make when you have that stylistic matchup. You know, everyone said to me after Pacquiao fight, they were like, "What's going to happen with him and Floyd?" I'm like, "Floyd's going to win easy." They're like, "You just lost him. How could you say that?" I'm like, "It's styles. Mm. I think I would give Floyd more trouble than Manny will, just because of the way their styles match up. It's just one of those things."
So you think you would have done better against Floyd than
I
you
think would've... so. I think with his high shoulder roll defense, fighting someone long and tall would have always given him trouble. I said Tommy Hearns would beat Floyd up, where I think Floyd would probably beat Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, he would be able to slow things down enough and kind of pick and go tick for tack. But Tommy, he could hit you from across the ring. He was a 6'1" welterweight. You know, with like an 80-inch reach. You know, that guy can hit you from across the ring. So now, this stuff, that shoulder roll defense, not going to work.
Because how common is it in with the promoters and the people setting these fights up where they avoid fights that they know stylistically or not? Is that common? Is it?
So when I talk to like people who don't really know the boxing world, I think of the promoters as almost like record labels, and they get artists, the talent, and they're going to protect their guys. So if their matchmakers are the best in the world at eyeing fights and matchups, and they'll be like, all right, well, this guy is not going to, they test him early and say, all right, he has trouble with these kinds of guys. We're going to kind of avoid those kind of guys at the top level. You know, it's like Manny, you know, has trouble with like he had trouble with Juan Manuel Marquez because he's a good counterpuncher. So like they end up fighting three times because Manny's a beast and fights everyone. But like the company didn't really like that fight, and they also didn't like the Floyd fight. I had heard that because of the style.
I feel like there's a science behind matching your fighter with the right person to create the right, and you also don't want to create a boring fight either. So it's kind of a delicate balance.
You got to test your guy, but he's still got to win. You know, so you want to put him in tough, but like it's still a fight that he's going to come out on top of. And you're right; it's an absolute science. And these matchmakers, they're basically handicappers, and they can see things. They've studied the game so long; they can catch little movements and whatnot. That all right, this is going to be the end of this fight, and this is how it's going to go.
Yeah, it's crazy. I had a client that was an old boxer. He was in his late 70s. I think I talked to him about him earlier, and he broke it all down for me. And we were talking about Mike Tyson, and he said Mike Tyson had such good balance, he could knock you out from anywhere, but he had no balance going backwards. So you just keep pushing him back with the double jab, and you throw his balance off, and that's what Buster Douglas did. That's exactly what Douglas did. And when he explained it to me, and then I watched fights later on, I was like, holy shit, like you don't realize the kind of science that goes into at this level of fighting.
It's a chess match, insane. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a chess match.
It's chess, not checkers, motherfucker. that's boxing. It's called the sweet science for a reason. You said it's science. You know, and it's such an old sport, and people have been working on this for so long, and you have two weapons. It's not four or eight. It's two.
Now, are there guys in the business that are known for this, like for helping fighters like you, like in the science of it, and like breaking it down like a chessboard?
The best trainers in the world, the guys that really analyze. You know, you got guys like, I mean, God rest in peace. You know, from the Kronk Gin, Emmanuel Stewart. I think he was one of the best that we've seen in a long time. But then you've got the guys like even Freddie Roach. You know, who found Manny and turned him into an absolute icon by matching up their style and the weight. I think the synergy that those two had as a coach and a fighter. I don't think without Manny, I don't think Freddie would have been as big as he was or is. And without Freddie, I don't think Manny would.
It was just a perfect matchup.
It was just perfect matchup.
So looking ahead, what are we looking at in the future for you? What are you working on now?
I'm looking to get back in the ring as soon as possible. I've stayed in great shape. You know, I needed some time off, get my body in the right place, you know, in terms of injuries and being healthy. Also getting my mind in the right place. My run was fast and furious, you know. I literally didn't even look back on it. Everybody's asking, "Oh, what's it been like?" I'm like, "I haven't even looked back yet. I haven't literally not looked in the rearview this whole time because I've just been going and going and going. I've had time to reflect, so I'm just looking. I'm really excited to get my career back going and hope I can get a fight in before the end of the year.
So is this going
to
be boxing or kickboxing? You mentioned
I always told myself, I've been saying it. I've had my careers planned out since I was a teenager. I said I was going to be a world champion in kickboxing. I was going to do it two times. I was going to do it two weight classes. I'm going to do it in two different organizations, and one of which had to be the ISK, which is the universally recognized world title in kickboxing. So I did that, and then I said I was going to go to boxing. And then I was going to win a world title. I was going to make $1 million, and I was going to retire. I did all that, but I still want to fight. So I still have that drive. Yeah, I still got that itch, and I still got it. So But I've always said I want to come back and have a kickboxing fight, at least one, because awesome. Those are my roots. I still love the sport. I said it earlier. I didn't leave it because I didn't like it. I left it because of other opportunities, being an opportunist. I think there's still a place for me.
Anyone in particular that you want to fight right now?
It's hard that we say that because like the landscape changes so much, especially the weight classes that I'm in now, 140. It's really kind of changing pretty drastically. But I mean,
lay out the landscape for us a little bit. Who's who right now in that weight class?
So there's the welterweight division, which is 147, which are my last couple fights have been. I'm a world champion at 140, so I'm actually moving back down to the 140s. To go back to kind of, I was undefeated world champion there, and then I moved up for the Pacquiao fight and kind of stayed up there because of certain opportunities and money fights that were available. Now I want to go back and win another world title, you know, and I think I'm better suited for the 140s. But 47 is funny because you've got these mega fights, the Manny Pacquiao's, the Mayweather's, but they're,
so you see a lot of money potential there.
And they're like, they don't even need weight classes. They fight wherever, you know. Like when I fought Manny, we fought at 144. Like that's not even a weight class, but he's that kind of guy that they can tell you where you're going to fight. Floyd's fighting McGregor at 54. Mm-hmm. You know, Floyd's not a 54 pounder; he's a 47 pounder. But you know, those kind of guys, it's all about the money at that point. Like, you can fight anywhere. So like the money's usually at the 47s. My last opponent, this kid Errol Spence, he's a monster. You know, he ended up going and knocking out the pretty tough world champion Kell Brook over in England. He's there, but I see him moving up. There's a couple other guys in the 40s that are kind of are transitioning weight classes. Guys grow out of weight classes. Guys get older. Guys chase money, and they'll leave. So a lot of times it can leave gaps and holes. So got to unify that stuff.
Does it change that fast? I mean, 6 months from now, it could be a whole different. Oh wow!
Think about Manny Pacquiao. He just lost to Jeff Horn, who's no one that has ever heard of. You know, and like. Everybody wanted the Pacquiao fight. It's like now it's like, want that. Yeah. You know, and that just happened. That was an overnight thing. It's like, well, Pacquiao didn't look so good. So.
Yesterday, hero, today, zero. Happens very quickly.
Yeah.
Man.
Wow.
It's all about what have you done for me lately. Yeah. You know,
well, shit. Well, I know you got to catch a flight here, man, but it was
keep it moving.
Awesome. Awesome having you on the show, brother.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Really appreciate it. Good time. Excellent.
What about me?
You're too, Frank.
Yeah.
You too, you handsome, you handsome fellow.
You're a tough guy.
You guys.
Check this out. Go to mindpumpmedia.com. Register yourself for 30 days of coaching for free. Also, if you go to YouTube, you can check out our channel, Mind Pump TV. We post a new video every single day. Lastly, Instagram. Find us there, Mind Pump Media. My page is Mind Pump Sal. Adam is Mind Pump Adam. And Justin is Mind Pump Justin. All right, Mind Pump fans. So there's a few podcasts that we like to listen to regularly. Not very many podcasts, but there's a few in particular. One of them is The Art of Charm. Some of the best interviews and content that I found in the podcast world. One episode in particular was pretty damn awesome. I think all of you should listen to it if you're into listening to compelling podcasting. This was podcast number 633. Art of Charm interviewed Jack Barsky, who's this KGB spy in America. So he's implanted in America from Soviet Union, but then he ends up that he loves America so much that he switched over to our side. It's a very compelling story. I'm actually here right now with Jordan from The Art of Charm. He's the host. Jordan, what was it like interviewing Jack Barsky?
This guy was super cool, man. He's obviously he's pretty old now, but this is a guy who studies in East Germany, grows up there, ends up going to Moscow, can't tell his family or friends what he's doing, leaves his family behind, his wife and kid, comes to America, steals a dead baby's identity, embeds himself at this company, this insurance company. He's working on computer stuff. And then after a while, he just realizes spying for the Soviet Union is just such a waste. So he's like, screw it. I'm staying here. He gets married, has another kid, and eventually the Soviet Union disintegrates, and he's just like, cool, nobody has any idea what's going on. Well, fast forward a few years later, the FBI catches up with him, and he ends up making friends with the FBI agent, not going to prison, helping the FBI with, you know, catching KGB spies. And he just unloads this whole story on this episode of The Art of Charm. It's a two-part episode. He talks about how he recruits spies, how the KGB was recruiting him, what spies need to know, all this human behavior reading stuff. Super, super interesting episode. Two-parter on AOC, which we never do. There's tons of stuff. This guy could talk for days.
I swear to God, Jordan, interview like the coolest people everywhere.
Yeah,
that's why I love your podcast so much. Where can people find you guys?
Sure. So you're already listening to a podcast. Just search for The Art of Charm in whatever podcast app, or just go to theartofcharm.com and you can find all the shows there.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, Matt's Performance, and Matt's Aesthetic. 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around, a watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom. And a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh, modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style. All for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.